Hello, and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have another episode where we would like to talk about more things that happened at the American College of Cardiology Scientific Sessions. So there was so much great information presented. GLP-1s are obviously a very, very hot topic, and we've got two presentations we really want to cover. So the first one is the SCORED trial, and this was basically a real-world trial with semaglutide 2.4, so Wegovy. And we talked in the past about the SELECT trial, which was done. It was multi-site randomized controlled trial of semaglutide 2.4 milligrams weekly in people with obesity and cardiovascular disease, and it showed a 20% reduction in cardiovascular events in that population. And that's really what helped get its indication now that we have this established indication for people with obesity and cardiovascular disease, which has allowed us to get it covered for our patients readily. So that has been fantastic. Now, we've also talked in the past about limitations to clinical trials, that it's a certain type of patient. Often it is in a fairly controlled setting where they're getting a lot of follow-up. People are checking in to see if they're taking their medication regularly. They're trying to make it as easy as possible to get the medication, not having to worry so much about the copays and all the other things, right? And so we want to know, how does it perform in a real-world setting? Because just because something does great in a trial doesn't necessarily mean it does well in the real world, right? So that was really the rationale behind this. So this is based on real-world data, looking at, you know, pharmacy claims and other clinic information. And what this trial did was there was 27,963 patients that had obesity or overweight and established cardiovascular disease. And so compared, when they matched this with non-users, the group that took semaglutide 2.4 milligrams was associated with a significantly lower risk of the three-point MACE, and that included heart attack, stroke, and all-cause death, and it was actually reduced by 57%. So it was even more in this real world setting compared to what we saw with SELECT. So in total, there were 42 events of the 9,321 patients taking the semaglutide, and there were 175 events in the 18,642 patients in the non-user group. Mean follow-up was 7.1 months for the semaglutide group and 6.4 months in the non-user. So pretty short amount of time to see quite a dramatic difference. So Natalie, curious your thoughts on this new data.
So I think that part of this is, you know, you're right. When we do clinical trials, we have a trial nurse calling the person in between visits. We have all kinds of protocols set up to encourage adherence to the medication, encourage question answering, encourage education around side effect profile. This was a retrospective analysis, and this is where that kind of trial, real world data, right? We're looking backwards and saying these people are actually taking the medication, and we can see that, and they already have cardiovascular disease, and we can see that. And now what does it do? These people aren't getting extra calls or extra follow-up or any of those extra things. They're paying real-world costs for these medications, and these outcomes are impressive, right? They're more impressive, actually, than the initial data was. So I am very happy about this. And again, just like you kind of hinted at, we really, really, really want more coverage for GLP-1s for overweight and obese to reduce those cardiovascular events. And this is really going to push insurance companies to say, we really have to do this. You know, the score results were consistent across the cardiovascular endpoints, including death too, right? So compared to non-users, semaglutide 2.4 was also associated with lower risk of ready hospitalization. That's another reason why an insurance company would say yes for heart failure, CV-related death and all-cause death. So, you know, we're always trying to say, okay, we have this data. What can we do? How can we use this to improve the lives of the people that we see every day? I'm hoping that that's going to make a huge difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's really impressive to see this kind of data. We are still waiting for the full publication. So this was presented at ACC. So we don't have, you know, the full publication yet. But I think these results look so, so promising. I mean, there's benefits. And then there's also some downsides to real world data. I think one of the downsides is that, you know, it's not randomized. So people could, there could be good reasons why some people were getting semaglutide and other people were not getting it. And that, you know, they try to account for those reasons when they match the groups, but it's hard to
pull
the possible confounders. So that's why it is important that we do the randomized control trials. But I think when you see that real world data supports what's already
kind of does this, right? It's like this building force, a foundation underneath to say, when we did this in a controlled setting, this is what we got. When we did this, when we looked back to see what these people that were using the drug, that, you know, this is what we have. And that just helps that situation, helps that that discussion, that argument to say this is important.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this data is so good. I think it's actually unethical not to offer this therapy.
That's exactly where we are, right? Where, you know, when we shut things down early, why do we stop trials early? A lot of times because one group is far out, performing the other in efficacy or whatever we're looking at, right? Safety, whatever that is. This is that where you have to say, okay, now how else do we, you know, yeah, I'm...
I mean, it's kind of like... when a therapy, you know, there's a therapy so good and it's not ethical to do a placebo controlled trial anymore. It's like this therapy now is so good. Like, what are we doing? We're going to deny people this really good therapy. So I really think people with established cardiovascular disease that also have obesity need to be on this medication or that can hopefully demonstrate the same impact in this population.
Right. I mean, we can remember as clinicians, when do we end trials? DCCT ended early, right? And that was that major trial that looked at the people getting intensive management on type 1, which is really what started all of our efforts to manage type 1 differently, right? Where A1Cs before that 8, 8.5, sometimes 9 was wildly accepted. And so all of a sudden we said, wait a minute, as we drop those A1Cs, and the reduction in microvascular disease was so significant in the people with intensive management that they ended the trial early. You know, this is that same idea. These people, we couldn't end this trial early because they were doing a retrospective analysis, right? This is not, we can't do it that way. But how many more trials do we have before someone will cover this for a medication for someone with overweight or obese? That's really the question at this point. So if you're at very high risk, you've already have some heart disease, or you're at high risk because you're both your parents and your brother all have heart disease. To me, that's enough to say we need to get you on this medication early and often and aggressively manage the weight alone.
Yeah. I mean, it is such a compelling indication now. I am so curious, though, like as long as we're talking on this topic, we're still waiting on the SURPASS CVOT trial. That's the one with tirzepatide. And that one is actually for type 2 diabetes to show the cardiovascular outcome data. But it reminds me how, you know, they're actually going head to head versus dulaglutide, not versus placebo. And I think that is what needs to happen because now this class of medication is just so powerful for people with cardiovascular disease that it just at this point, like we should not be using placebo anymore. So it'll be so interesting how that plays out. And of course, like we're still, you know, we don't have data yet on that population in obesity. So while we're all kind of like, oh yeah, it should, hopefully we'll see positive data. There's positive data on blood pressure and cholesterol and we're all expecting it. But until you prove it, you just don't know for sure. And so
Absolutely.
That's the power of these trials, like showing in randomized control trial, real world setting, this type of data with these hard outcomes, with these major adverse cardiovascular events, like that is truly a big deal. And so, yeah, I'm excited about this.
Me too. Yep. More to come.
Yeah, so let's talk about this meta-analysis that was done and presented at ACC. So long title, Cardiovascular and Kidney Outcomes and Mortality with Long-Acting Injectable and Oral Glucagon-like Peptide 1 Receptor Agonists in Individuals with Type 2 Diabetes. This was a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized trials. So the question, what is the question, right? When we start these kind of analyses, we need to have a question. Do long-acting GLP-1 receptor agonists, including subcutaneous and oral, they looked at both, improve cardiovascular and kidney outcomes and mortality in type 2 diabetes? So this was a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized placebo-controlled trials, including the new data from SOUL and FLOW, both of those trials we've gone over in the past. So let's look at this. So there were 10 trials involved in this meta-analysis with 71,351 persons with diabetes. So outcomes are significant across all of the things that we're looking for when we use these medications with people with diabetes, right? Major adverse cardiac events down by 14%, all-cause mortality down 12%. Hospitalization for heart failure. Remember, we used to only use what? SGLT2s for heart failure. That was like 2 years ago. That was the memory thing, right? This was the new guidance. Now that guidance is blurring, isn't it? So hospitalization for heart failure down 14%. Composite kidney outcome down 17%. Safety outcomes. I love this. No change in severe hypoglycemia, retinopathy, or pancreatitis. So we have these cautions in place, but they didn't really, that wasn't seen in these trials. And then safety outcomes, including cancer, no change in difference in cancer, pancreatic cancer, or any thyroid cancer for that matter. So this is really powerful, powerful stuff. So Diana, talk to us. What do you think?
I mean, it's super impressive. Like across every single cardiovascular event, the kidney disease, like everything was favorable and statistically significant. It's really, I mean, it's quite remarkable because some of the individual studies didn't necessarily show that. Like, for example, Excel with the long-acting exenatide. And then also with the lixisenatide. So there are some studies that didn't have this powerful data, but then when they're all grouped together, we see this just this powerful result. So it definitely reinforces this class effect of like just this really positive cardiovascular outcomes.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, when people are in my office and I'm seeing them individually or as a family, you know, diabetes becomes a cardiovascular disease, right? People with diabetes die of heart attacks and strokes at a much higher rate. These are the medications that we should be using early and often. You know, so occasionally I get someone who says, well, how often are you using a GLP-1? It's like, well, every single time I can. I mean, and that's really this idea of every single time you can, as long as it's tolerated, as long as the person can find a way to cover it. Right? To have a copay that's reasonable to them. Some people even get it for free. Don't get me wrong, that this should be at the top of the list. And so that is, you know, that is what this just gives me more strength in my discussion, I guess, as to, so sometimes we get someone who only has one benefit or one brand of product. But to me, because this is a composite, this is an analysis of all different medications across 71,000 people, what I would say is that I'm going to give you whatever one is covered. Let's get you started and then decide from there rather than say, oh, my favorite one isn't. Maybe I'll try something. No, no. Stick with the GLP-1. Use it often. Use it early. And with this in the back of your mind, you know, just to say to someone, I'm going to reduce your risk of heart attack, major cardio adverse events by up, you know, on average 14%. A lot of times people who even say, I don't want this, will say, of course, I'll take it now. And this also includes the oral. And I think that Sometimes we have in the past said, well, the injectables aren't as good or is better than the orals and blah, blah, blah. To me, it now says to me in this meta-analysis, orals were included. So I feel more confident. And we've had some new data on the orals that this is impressive.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it just reinforces the great class effect and that they very much should be high up in the guidelines. And so I think the change that we've seen over the years with the guidelines of metformin really falling out of favor is first line. It's no longer prominently up there. I mean, on a practical level, people take it first line because of the cost. But when you see this powerful of a class effect, I mean, I would want to be on this first line. I think the only thing that prevents us from using it first line is really the cost of it.
Right. And I think, too, you know, metformin has its place. I mean, it does reduce A1C pretty significantly, right? So to me, it's like, instead of going metformin, wait 3 months, go up by another pill, right? We used to have this whole slow, it would take almost a whole year to get someone to 2,000, you know, milligrams a day, right? Now we can say, we're going to titrate you up with metformin and start this other medication. And we can do them both a little bit at a time, slowly if we want to, whatever. But I am, you know, the challenge you and I have is that we're already in endocrinology. So everyone who comes in is either on metformin or can't handle it because of GI side effects, right? We don't see very many people who were not started on it. So it's hard for us because we're not in that primary care space to say, I would probably have a really hard struggle with only starting metformin. I would almost always start a metformin with a GLP-1 almost every time, right? Like, or know that they're coming back in a month and then we're going to start it, right? Like just quickly, not this 6 or 3 months or a year later, no matter what the AC is.
I agree that metformin is a great drug. It's just that if I had my perfect world, if someone's newly diagnosed, and especially if they have overweight obesity, I'd say, like, let's start this once a week therapy.
Right.
And down the road, if they need additional glucose lowering, then I'd add metformin. It's still a great, great drug. I just think we use it first because of the cost and the accessibility. It could be a later therapy. It's just on a practical level, it's hard to actually do that because a lot of insurance plans are like, well, you got to show you've been on metformin.
Well, that's it. Right. Exactly. Right. And so that's kind of my side of it, too, is that, you know, yes, in an ideal world, we would give them all a GLP-1 with an SGLT2 inhibitor even, right, for a lot of people, even at the same time, you know, and then add metformin maybe later, but maybe, you know, but most of the insurance companies will not allow a GLP-1 without something else beforehand, no matter what the guidelines say, even if I would like to do it, right? And that's the hard part about this, you know, is that but all of this data should be helping us encourage and push the insurance companies to make clinical decisions about outcomes, right? So hopefully we'll see that in the future.
For sure. Yeah. All right. Well, great discussion. So much good stuff lately at all these meetings. Thank you all for tuning in. That wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.